Hello and welcome to The Wire, your independent national coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Amina Shakur coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. And today on the show...
Many of the videos were talking about this growing desire to be hormone-free and endorsing natural contraceptive methods.
Young women at risk of unplanned pregnancies after listening to TikTok advice.
And there's about 4,400 people that have been hospitalised in Queensland this year. About 85 to 90% of those being hospitalised have not been vaccinated.
Most of the hospitalised patients in Queensland for the flu are unvaccinated. And later today...
Disaster communication messages are either too complex or too vague.
Researchers are using storytelling to bridge cultural gaps and improve disaster communication. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Misleading birth control advice on TikTok is putting young people at risk of unplanned pregnancies. A new study from La Trobe University found that many high-viewed videos promote ineffective natural methods and reject hormonal contraception, often without medical context. I spoke with lecturer at La Trobe University, Megan Bagden, about the spread of misinformation amplified by TikTok's algorithm.
What concerns do you have about the way TikTok is influencing young people's contraceptive decisions?
I think the main concern that we had from our study was that the information that they're accessing is not always reliable or of good quality. So we noticed internationally that unplanned pregnancies are increasing, and some organisations had suggested social media plays an important role in that. But no one had yet looked at TikTok, and that's a really, you know, increasingly used platform where individuals share their personal experiences of lots of different health-related things, including contraceptive information. So we really wanted to look at, you know, what are the, what's the quality and reliability of information in the most viewed TikToks on contraceptive health. So we looked at 100 of the most viewed, and we assessed the quality and reliability. And when we looked at quality and reliability, we used a scale that would assess things like, is the uploader demonstrating bias? Do they mention where the sources of their information come from? Did they tell the audience where they can get further information about the contraceptive health devices that they're talking about or issues that they're discussing? Or did they disclose that this was just their personal experience that they're talking about and that they should seek further information? Probably not too surprising thing for us was that most of these videos scored extremely poorly in terms of these measures. Most was based on personal experience and beliefs, and there was very little information that was based on medical evidence and done by medical professionals. So there was quite a big gap in terms of the information being shared on these platforms in a lot of regards, but particularly there was one good example that we found, which was many of the videos were talking about this growing desire to be hormone-free and endorsing natural contraceptive methods like fertility awareness-based methods or tracking. But these videos in particular often failed to disclose the limitations of the method, like motivation, partner cooperation, and biological variabilities, and often failed to mention that these are generally ineffective when used on their own. They often require a barrier method at some point within that fertility cycle.
You mentioned that TikTok algorithm gives, I guess, influencers greater reach than medical experts. How does that impact the quality of information young people receive and who they receive it from?
Yeah. So, I mean, influencers in general, they have a high following. They algorithms tend to prioritise resharing those videos, but they also tend to prioritise the sharing of negative health experiences and opinions. And so that was something that, you know, we saw come through in our research. And so the potential implication of that is that young people, once they start to hear a couple of negative health experiences relating to contraception or distrust in medical professionals, which came through in our study, they tend to see more and more of that opinion, and then that then forms their belief systems, which they then, you know, use to inform their contraceptive decisions, or which they then take with them when they are navigating the health system, when they're talking to GPs or other medical professionals about their contraceptive decisions.
I mean, we talked a lot about the negatives. Is there any positives when it comes to TikTok specifically around educating young people on contraceptive decisions?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's definitely a platform in particular for women where they've been able to feel comfortable sharing negative experiences of their, you know, that they've had within the health system, and that knowledge and that information is always, you know, can always be powerful for young people to have. But the thing that we would always say is make sure you're always questioning, you know, has the information you've seen referred to where they've found their evidence.
And I guess going to medical practice, what role do our healthcare professionals play in building that trust between young people around contraception?
Yeah, I think a really important one, and increasingly so. You know, if we see that many young people today are using TikTok as that go-to source of information on reproductive health, whether reliable or not, you know, that's informing a lot of the decisions and information that they have relating to their contraceptive choices. So it's important for medical professionals to understand that individuals might be coming to them with ideas that may be biased and may not be accurate. So it's important that health professionals work on rebuilding that trust and with individuals, and focusing on what does shared decision making on contraceptive options look like. You know, do GPs spend time talking through what the multiple options are and the pros and cons, giving individuals time and space to decide what suits them best.
What message would you give to young people, you know, getting those contraceptive information from sources like TikTok?
Yeah, I would say, you know, it's hard at the moment to distinguish credible health information from misleading content. There's a lot of work as public health professionals that we need to do in this space to, you know, collaborate with influencers to increase the reach of accurate information for them. But in the meantime, think about, you know, where is the information coming from that you're seeing? What's informed their opinions?
That was a lecturer at La Trobe University, Megan Bagden, speaking to The Wire. It's festival season across Australia, but along with the big gathering comes a less welcomed guest, the flu. Queensland has already seen almost 44,000 cases this year, 20% more than last year. According to Queensland Health, 86% of hospitalised patients with the flu were unvaccinated. The Wise Azucena Carrasco spoke with President of the Pharmacy Guild of Queensland, Chris Owen, to find out more.
So we do have seasonal variability in between years about climate, travel, and the ability of gatherings to occur. So we know that during COVID we had a much reduced rate because a lot of people weren't coming into contact, but since then we've seen a gradual increase every year. And it is a little bit concerning that we do have a declining vaccination rate despite the fact that the Queensland State Government has made this vaccine available for free for everyone.
That's
so
right.
It is quite concerning, and we're looking forward to hopefully trying to find out some of the reasons why, or some of the motivations why people aren't going out and getting that vaccine.
Because in Queensland in particular, the flu cases are up nearly 20%. How does this compare to other states?
So the rate of infection is roughly the same, but what we're seeing uniquely in Queensland is the hospitalisations, and there's about 4,400 people that have been hospitalised in Queensland this year. About 85 to 90% of those being hospitalised have not been vaccinated. So, and you mentioned the 44,000 of those, 90% of people, of those confirmed cases, are not vaccinated. So we're seeing some very clear evidence that people who are being vaccinated are less likely to be hospitalised and they're less likely to actually have a confirmed case of the flu. So I would like to think that Queenslanders are trying to do the right thing, but on the evidence of our vaccination rates, we are certainly behind our southern neighbours. And we would hope that, given that we're getting towards the end of the season, that there's never been a better time than now to try and go out and do your part and get that vaccination.
Okay, because if we can come back to that figure, which is 90% of flu hospitalizations in Queensland are unvaccinated, how strong is the protection the flu shot provides?
So it is important that within our body we have a natural immune system that is very good at fighting off disease. But every now and then we do need to re-up our protection. So if we don't have a body that is fighting fit, we haven't done our exercise to build that strength up in the system, then it is going to take longer to be able to fight that disease. So what the flu vaccine does, it provides a recent exercise for the body to be able to fight a similar disease. And that way, when the actual flu does come along, our body is ready, it recognises it early, and it has the memory cells to go out and fight that infection immediately. So it does provide for a much quicker response and a much heavier response to when those viral cells do come into contact with the body, which means that you don't get as sick and you are less likely to be hospitalised and certainly much less likely for death.
So the vaccine, let's do this as a reminder, is free for all Queenslanders aged 6 months and older. So how easy it is for people to access it through their local community pharmacy?
So it's very easy to get it through the community pharmacy, but also through your GP or health clinics. For pharmacists specifically, we have a website called findapharmacy.com.au, and that has all the pharmacies linked to it and their available appointments. Alternatively, you can just walk into a local community pharmacy and ask the pharmacist or one of the staff in the pharmacy for the flu vaccine, and 9 times out of 10 they're happy to do it on the spot. So you don't necessarily need an appointment, but if it fits into your lifestyle that you want an appointment, go to the website. Otherwise, just walk into your local pharmacy and they should be able to do it on the spot.
So basically, even though we are in August, you're saying that it's still worth getting vaccinated now?
Absolutely. There's never a bad time to get a flu vaccination, even in summer, particularly what we're seeing overwhelmingly in more recent years is those foreign influences. So if we have a northern hemisphere winter, and then they're coming here in summer or spring or autumn, that we are seeing a particularly high number of those introduced cases from overseas. So while our winter season for local transmission is getting its peak right now, this is no bad time. And certainly it provides you protection through the next 6 to 9 months as well.
Do you think that that is enough protection, definitely, for how much longer the flu season is likely to last?
Absolutely. Without a doubt, there is no bad time to get a flu vaccination. It does take about a week to get to its full effectiveness. So while we have a month left, there's still going to be residual protection that happens all the way through to the end of the year. So whether you get the flu vaccination in March or you get it in August, there's no bad times.
Chris Owen from the Pharmacy Guild of Queensland there, speaking with The Wire's Azucena Carrasco. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Amina Shakur in Melbourne. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on 8CCC 102.1 FM. And to our friends in Noosa on Noosa FM 101.3. And to the other side of the country to Radio Goolari in Broome, Western Australia. Culturally and linguistically diverse communities, or CALD communities for short, are left out of disaster and crisis management due to language and cultural divide. Researchers at QUT have undertaken a project to use storytelling techniques, often familiar with CALD groups, to more effectively transfer information and protocols before, during, and after disaster or crisis. Team lead on the project, Associate Professor Jenny Howe, says utilising storytelling crosses cultural barriers, much like music, and can greatly help throughout the whole process. The Wire's Zachary Prober spoke further to Associate Professor Howe about the project.
People often think the primary barrier is language, and yes, that's part of the problem. However, our research reveals that the challenges go much deeper. For example, some disaster communication messages are either too complex or too vague. So even when people get warning messages, but still don't know exactly what to do next. And another big gap is that the messages often lack cultural connection. Yes, of course, they inform and update the disaster situation, but they don't necessarily always engage with people's values, experiences, or trusted networks. And when code communities are represented in the media, they are often portrayed as victims, which overlooks the cultural knowledge and the resilience they already have. And that's a missed opportunity to build on those.
Yeah. How is your research at QUT looking to solve these kind of issues then?
There's no easy fix, but our approach was to bring code communities and emergency management professionals to the same table and co-design solutions. We kind of try to, it's about blending two things, scientific guidance and cultural appropriateness into emergency communication that actually works for people. For example, we've run co-design and co-production workshops where community members and policymakers mapped out local service networks and created practical resources like ecosystem maps so people know exactly where to get help in an emergency. It's not us telling communities what they need. It's really about working with them to create tools they can actually use.
How long did this research take, and how soon are you looking at implementing those recommendations?
Our project began in early 2023 and has been running for almost 3 years. We've just launched our report, toolkit, and the resources publicly, and now the focus is on putting them into action. For example, I have already started working with Get Ready Queensland, the state's peak body for emergency management and disaster risk education, by integrating our research findings into local action plans. And also, I'd like to take this opportunity to invite councils, multicultural organizations, and community groups to use our open access toolkit and the resources. The goal is to see these resources in the hands of people who actually need them and can bring them to life. The sooner, the better.
Were there any takeaways that you saw throughout this process that really could be applied to, I suppose, non-cold communities?
Even though our work focuses on the multicultural or cold communities, the principles can benefit everyone and every community. Resilience is stronger when it's shared. For example, one key takeaway from our project is the importance of embedding humanity into disaster resilience by recognizing the universal human needs, rights, and well-being in disaster situations, regardless of cultural or linguistic differences. And that also means understanding humanity means we need to advance inclusion in a systematic level, and also see diversity as a strength and build trust and connection across all communities. The more we understand each other, the better we can work together in a crisis.
That was Associate Professor Jenny Howe speaking with The Wire's Zachary Probert. The Great National Koala Park is an initiative by the New South Wales government which aims to protect koalas and other species around the mid-north coast. But it's been 2 years since it was announced, and the state government has still not confirmed and approved a designated outline of the park. Advocates and environment groups are concerned about the koalas and other species found in the area, with the risk of being endangered or even extinct. Peter Elzar, known as Koala Man, is walking from Coffs Harbour to Sydney to demand the state government act on the park and protect the koalas. The Wise contributor from 2NUR, Peter Hislop, asked Peter Elzar what motivated him to walk all the way down to Sydney.
Well, there's two reasons mainly. I've been in Coffs Harbour for 50 years. I've seen the decline of our local koala and other populations, including quolls. And my children used to go to primary school with koalas in the schoolyard. They don't exist anymore now, 30 years later. And prior to the last state election, Chris Minns and Penny Sharp announced they'd be establishing a koala park. This is 2.5 years ago. It still hasn't been done. And what they've done is actually the reverse of what they said they were going to do, and intensified their logging in those areas. And, I and many other people are very, very annoyed. I'm just walking past some workers. How are you going, fellas? Yeah, good. Sorry. And we're quite annoyed, and we're asking for that Great Koala National Park to be implemented immediately. And the other issue is we need to start the debate in New South Wales. I'm out of breath.
That's okay. I'll talk for a little bit so that you can catch your breath again, Peter. This year, so it's quite obviously a dire situation, but you're making the most out of the situation. I understand that you're walking down the M1 with a big koala head on. You just walked past some workers. What's their response when they see a man with a big koala head walking down the freeway?
It's astonishment, you know. This crazy guy walking down the highway waving to everyone. It's through the middle of the rain yesterday, and but when they see, they sort of, most of the responses are favourable,
I'd imagine. And I guess you're walking all the way down to Parliament House in Sydney. What are some of the key things that you'll be lobbying the Premier about, and are you expecting him to make a trip down from his office because he sees the koala men out the front?
Yes, well, I hope so, but I don't think so. Last time I was there, a couple of months ago, in front of Parliament House for 2 weeks with Fasting for Forests Action, I did a 12-day hunger strike as such. And Penny Sharp did come down, to her credit, spoke with me on the footpath. She's the Environment Minister, but it's the same old, and it's just not good enough. And I'll be handing Chris a letter, either personally or via someone else, with a plea from the koalas and all the endangered and critically endangered creatures to change our forestry management practices, because all the environmentalists, all the scientists are telling us that we have to.
Yeah, of course. You've done a fair bit of, I can see, just looking up your name, you've done a fair bit of course, advocacy. I understand that you've also done a fair bit of walking before, and longer walks than this one even. What's it like to be doing such a long distance walk? How do you prepare for it, and how do you, I guess, keep it going?
Well, it's 67 last time and 70 this time. It's getting a little harder, but It's the physical preparation is not too bad. It's once you've got that down pat, you actually get stronger on the walk. It's what's up top in the brain, actually, that makes a difference. So if you've got very little up there, it makes it easier.
For sure. Peter, it's so good to chat to you. I mean, all the best on your walk. Is there anything else that you wanted to add while I've still got you?
Yes, I'm talking with 2NUR, so I'm walking in the Hunter Street today. Knitting Nanas will be welcoming me outside the local state member's office and to hand a local state member of Newcastle a similar plea.
Activist Peter Elzar there, speaking to 2NUR's Peter Hislop. And unfortunately, that is the end of today's show. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations to SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide for Triple Z, and Radio 4EB in Brisbane. With the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website, thewire.org.au, and follow us on Facebook, X, and LinkedIn. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present, and emerging. I'm Amin Shakur, coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.